TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Silent Summer. Professor Timothy Mousseau. What happens to the lives of birds, insects, and plants in the radiation zones around Chernobyl and Fukushima? You may remember a TUC Radio broadcast on the second anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. The biologist Tim Mousseau spoke at the Fukushima Symposium in New York that was organized by the physician Dr. Helen Caldicott. He concluded his talk by showing heartbreaking pictures of the birds of Chernobyl and their tumors and birth defects, and Helen Caldicott stepped up to the podium to thank him. She said, "I want to pay homage to Tim Mousseau, who with his colleagues is actually endangering his life by going into extremely high radioactive areas doing pioneering work, which is going to change the concept of radiation exposure to humans. What is happening to the animals, the insects, and the plants is going to happen to us." Tim Mousseau is professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. For 15 years, he and his scientific collaborator Anders Moller from the University of Paris, Sud, have done research in the most contaminated areas of Chernobyl. When Fukushima Daiichi exploded, they began fieldwork there as well. They study birds, insects, microbes, and plants at over 1,000 sites, creating the most diligent inventories of each study area and returning year after year. In the fall of 2015, Tim Mousseau was on his way to Fukushima to follow up. He stopped over in San Francisco and went on to Point Reyes Station. Programmers at the radio station KWMR and the Ecological Options Network had invited him to give a talk. Here is Tim Mousseau speaking at the Point Reyes Dance Palace on the contamination of the biosphere.
Well, so tonight my job is to share with you some of the work that we've been doing in Chernobyl and since about 2000 in Fukushima, more recently, two huge events. And, you know, up until a few years ago, I used to get the question all the time, why are you working in Chernobyl? Why are you bothering to study the effects of the Chernobyl disaster? And the reason people were asking me this is because everybody thought it was a unique event. It was unique to the former Soviet Union. It was unique to their management style, their engineering. It could never happen again, right? And of course, Fukushima proved that that isn't the case. And in fact, if you really want to know why we should be doing a lot more research in this area, you really only have to look very, very superficially at the history of nuclear power. And, essentially, there have been about 600 reactors, plus or minus, since the beginning of time, and currently about 430 around the world in 31 countries, about 100 here in the U.S., plus or minus. We've got a bunch of new ones under construction around the world. There's four new reactors being built within 60 miles of my house in South Carolina right now. I'm not kidding you. And so, you know, nuclear is not going away. No matter what you think about nuclear power, it's here for a little while longer, at least in some parts of the world. But in this time, there have been three major accidents at the commercial nuclear power plants. That's a fairly high frequency, really, when you think about it. And there's been plenty more smaller incidents and accidents. And given that most nuclear power plants, most of them are getting older, and many of them nearing the end of their useful lifespan, we're expecting to see more accidents. In fact, there was a recent study published or promoted by MIT not too long ago that suggested that we will see another Chernobyl-scale nuclear accident by the year 2050. And we're likely to see a Three Mile Island scale event within the next 10 years, based on a much larger data set than had been put together prior to this past year frequencies of accidents and engineering analyses. So we need to know more. We need to know what the consequences of accidents might be. Most of these power plants, of course, have huge stockpiles of spent fuel, and that's another issue. Another reason for understanding the effects of radioactivity in the environment is the fact that, and I didn't know this until 5 years ago, really, when I got involved in these National Academy panels, every single nuclear power plant, by design, releases literally tons of nuclear effluent every year. Of course they do. That's how we generate electricity. We're using fission, and the product of fission are these radioactive daughters that have to be dealt with. And most of them are dribbled out into the water or into the air. And of course, as we all know, the solution to pollution is dilution, right? So as long as we can dilute the effluent below these regulatory limits that are rather arbitrarily set, then there's no problem. Well, at least for the power plant companies, they're operating legally if they can do that. But anyway, every nuclear power plant releases lots and lots of radioactivity, but for the most part, we have little knowledge of the environmental impacts of these effluents. Now, of course, we also discovered recently that most of the nuclear power plants out there have illegal releases as well, releases that, you know, that just by accident, of course. And so, you know, we started to pay attention when it was noticed that the Vermont Yankee plant was leaking tritium off-site. And at the time, I was on a National Academy panel where they were asking, so what is the impact of leaking tritium? And we got all together for a couple of days and tried to figure this out and realized that there was insufficient scientific data to really answer the question for Congress. We really had no idea. We didn't think it was good. We didn't think it was a huge problem at this point, because for the most part, the nuclear power plants were only leaking on site. Most of them were not leaking it too far beyond the boundaries of the actual power plant. But in truth, we really didn't know. And that was kind of a wake-up call for a lot of people. But still, to this day, there's not a lot of research going on with respect to radiation or tritium leaks. But we are learning a little bit more every day as people put things together. There was a recent meta-analysis. This is the kind of study where you take a bunch of different studies and put them together and statistically analyze the combined data set. And when you do this for studies done in Europe primarily, epidemiological studies, what we've discovered is that if you are a pregnant woman living within 3 miles of a nuclear power plant, you have about a 100% increase, a doubling increase of the probability of your child getting leukemia. Now, that sounds terrible in one way. It certainly is terrible if your child has leukemia, if you've won the negative lottery, as it were. Luckily, childhood leukemia is a very, very rare disease, so the absolute frequencies of this disease are quite low. We need to know more. We had the 60th anniversary of the bombs being dropped on Japan, and most of what we know about the effects of radiation in the environment actually come from the studies of the atomic bomb survivors. Unfortunately, those studies didn't really start till 5, 6, 7 years after the bombs being dropped, so we missed a lot of information from that, but we have learned a lot. But we didn't actually study the effects on the environment, per se, following the atomic bombs. We have studied the effects on people, but we haven't looked at the animal populations particularly. So another reason, especially given that there have been just an enormous, I had no idea until a few years ago, We were just going crazy back in the 50s and 60s testing atomic bombs. There were 1,193 atmospheric tests conducted around the world. I think about 400 of them by the U.S., maybe a few more than that. Total 2,700 atomic bomb tests. They released, as Ken showed earlier, enormous quantities of radioactivity that still linger at relatively high levels in some parts of the world where the testing was conducted, like the Marshall Islands, parts of the Sahara where the French were testing bombs. But again, nobody has studied the impacts on the biota in the area. So another reason for doing it. So we decided, my research team, just completely by accident, I started off as an evolutionary biologist. I'm still an evolutionary biologist, and my motivation and interest in this topic results from an interest in evolutionary biology. How are natural populations changing, adapting in response to this novel stressor? I used to work on climate change, now I work on radiation. So we started working in Chernobyl about 15 years ago. Here's a map of the Chernobyl disaster impacts. Again, 200,000 square kilometers significantly impacted with radiation. Most people know about the stuff in Ukraine and Belarus and parts of Russia. Most people don't realize that large swaths of Scandinavia and Central Europe were also significantly contaminated. Here's a map, similar map for terrestrial Japan. Much smaller event from a terrestrial standpoint in terms of land mass contaminated. The Fukushima disaster is on the order of a tenth or less of the Chernobyl disaster. The Chernobyl disaster was just huge in terms of terrestrial impacts. Enormous quantities of materials released from Fukushima into the ocean. Their impacts, their biological impacts, largely unknown at this point. So why hasn't there been more investment in basic research associated with these kinds of events? I would argue that in part it's because of the attitudes that have been presented by agencies, intergovernmental agencies in charge of promoting the peaceful use of atomic energy, right? For instance, the IAEA, who suggested in their report from 10 years ago that we had nothing to worry about. In fact, you've probably seen the TV shows that have suggested that the Chernobyl zone is thriving, the animals are doing great because there's a fence and there's no people, and the effects of people are bigger than the effects of radiation. But there were no data presented to support that. There were no scientific studies to support that. This report from the International Atomic Energy Agency from the Director General just came out this week relating to Fukushima, and it's largely based on the UNSCAR report that came out last year. It's a complete whitewash. They have not reviewed the literature, is what I'm saying. They have not commissioned any scientific research. They have not paid attention to the scientific research that has been generated in the last 10 years from Chernobyl and the last 4 years from Fukushima. No rigorous empirical scientific data. So anyway, a few years ago in 2000, just out of casual curiosity, a colleague of mine, Anders Mahler, who is a very prominent biologist, we decided to work together on this project, visit Chernobyl, and kind of as a sideline, start looking at some of the birds in Chernobyl and see what was going on with them. We thought it would be a novel, new, creative approach to studying evolutionary processes. And of course, that's been very interesting. We started working together there in July of 2011, so a few months after the disaster in Fukushima. We're mostly interested in, as the physicists say, we're the bird and bunny guys. You know, we're interested in birds and bunnies, and it's kind of derogatory, I know, but it is true. We've been interested in basically the biological endpoints, and we've also been interested in the children, more or less. Made a whole bunch of visits to Chernobyl and Fukushima over the years, and published. We're over 80 papers now. And one thing I did want to mention is that, you know, we consider ourselves to be independent scientists. We're not anti-nuclear activists at all. We're simply scientists looking to find new things to see. The work that we do is driven by simple hypotheses and questions. And you know, very, very simple logic, straightforward logic is what governs what we do. The first question is simply, are the doses that we see in these areas high enough to cause genetic damage, mutations to the organisms? Pretty simple. If we don't see any evidence of genetic damage, then we don't have to look any further. We don't need to be concerned, right? But if we do see genetic damage, that's not enough by itself. Certainly a good hint, but it's not enough. And so the next question is, are there consequences to the shape and size, performance of the organisms as a result of the genetic damage? Are there fitness consequences? Is there any evidence of adaptation? Are there effects leading to population changes in terms of abundances and diversity? And finally, are there ecosystem functioning consequences to that? And that's been the driving force of what we're doing. So what have we found? And I don't have enough time to really go into any detail. I'm going to zip through, hit the highlights. If any of you are interested, our website has links to most of our papers. I encourage you to go there, and of course, you're welcome to ask me any questions you'd like. Right, first thing, start with the mutation stuff, the genetic damage stuff. So we've done all sorts of studies looking for genetic damage in a whole bunch of different ways and a whole bunch of different critters, and other people have as well. This year we published a paper which basically was a meta-analysis. It's one of these analyses of analyses, basically where we take data from all different sources, put it together and analyze it in a combined data set. Gives us a lot more power to look at patterns. And the basic finding was that radiation from Chernobyl causes mutations. Big surprise. It was overwhelming. The size of the effect due to Chernobyl radiation was extremely large, and it's no big surprise. Radiation causes genetic damage in Chernobyl. So what are the consequences? Does it matter? Maybe, you know, we all have mutations. We all accumulate mutations with every cell division. And in fact, our cells are working as hard as they can to repair the genetic damage that occurs as a normal part of physiology. One of my friend's colleagues told me that with every cell division, there are 50 breaks in the chromosomes that have to be repaired. So radiation is just adding to that. But so maybe there aren't any visible consequences of the added mutational load. Well, there are lots and lots.
You're listening to Professor Timothy Mousseau. If you would like to get the background information for his research, you can find his website under Faculty at the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina. Here's a summary of the slides that he showed. Mousseau and Mahler found many cases of tumors, abnormalities, aberrations, and close dose-response relationships. He remembered first seeing birds with white patches of feathers in Chernobyl, and now in Fukushima. He and his colleagues developed a way of taking sperm from birds without hurting them, and discovered that the count was low, or there was no sperm at all. Since we know from atomic bomb victims that the cells in the lens of the eyes are susceptible to ionizing radiation, they began looking for similar effects in the birds of Chernobyl and found a high percentage of cataracts. When they looked at rodents, they found the same results. In that context, they found that females are more susceptible to radiation, and they're still unsure why that is. Mousseau and Mahler looked at females of a species more closely, and they discovered a phenomenon in birds that is known for almost 100 years in women, microencephaly. Tim Mousseau.
Another thing that was first noticed in women, pregnant women who were treated with radium therapy and X-ray therapy in the 20s, when they started using X-rays and radium to treat cancers. But some of the women were pregnant, and so they actually discovered first that these children of these women were much more likely to show microencephaly, smaller brains, and developmental problems, also discovered in the atomic bomb survivors. So we started looking at the birds. And sure enough, birds from the more radioactive area had about 5% smaller brains. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it turns out that a bird with a 5% smaller brain has about a 50% lower chance of surviving from 1 year to the next, again suggesting that there are cognitive consequences of this effect. Again, not particularly surprising given what we've known of radiation effects from the medical literature, but again, surprising that we hadn't done any this kind of research in Chernobyl. The rodents show the same kind of effect in both Chernobyl and in Fukushima. Smaller brains in the more radioactive areas. Essentially, everything we look at, sometimes the insects are a fun tool to use because they're easy to catch and they often have interesting patterns on their bodies. Well, we were walking around Pripyat. This is this town just outside of near the reactor that was built to house the engineers at Chernobyl. Walking through Pripyat one day, and actually we were collecting flowers for pollen, and my colleague Anders looked down on the ground, and there was one of these firebugs, and he pulls it up and he goes, "Tim, look, this one's missing an eye." Sure enough, and so we started collecting them. And in that one day, we collected a whole bunch. I've put a few postcards out in the lobby if any of you want this picture. And, of course, we have it on the website if you want it. I thought it was just remarkable how easy it was to capture the impact of radiation on development using this kind of a model. We also started seeing strange growth forms in the trees. These are pine trees from Chernobyl. Again, very, very strange growth forms. Strange color changes. If any of you are familiar with the Yablokov book on Chernobyl, may recognize this from the cover. It's one of my photos, again, showing changes in the color and quality of the wood. Again, major impacts. Just this week, a paper published out of Japan showing similar consequences for the fir trees in around Fukushima in response to the radiation. So, bottom line, we know there's lots of mutations, lots of genetic effects. We know there are tons of phenotypic consequences, from very, very obvious to much more subtle, but absolutely no question consequences, developmental consequences of this added mutational load. But does it matter? Does it really matter in terms of ecology? Does it matter in terms of the abundance and biodiversity of the organisms that are there? And that really has been, this has really been the main focus of a lot of our work. And we've taken kind of an unusual approach that hasn't really been done before. What we decided to do, because we didn't know exactly how many critters were there before these disasters, right? You never have baseline data for these disasters. By definition, they're unpredictable. And so you have to come up with clever ways to generate predictions about what was there before so that you can compare that to what you see now. And so the way we've gotten at this is to do what I call massively replicated biotic inventories, where we go to many, many places, count all the critters we see at that given location, and put that into a giant statistical model. In Chernobyl, we've gone to Ukraine and Belarus and looked at about 400 different locations a few times. In Fukushima, we've gone to 400 locations for 4 years now and basically surveyed the range of critters at a range of radioactive contamination levels. And again, we put it into this kind of a model where we have our inventories, we have our measures of everything else that's important to the distribution and abundance of an organism, not just radiation. So, you know, bird distribution is determined by a lot of things, not just one thing. So if you're going to ask the question about radiation, you have to know the other factors that are also influencing their distribution. And then you have to have radiation measurements and GIS and some multivariate statistics. And using that, you can predict what should be in a given place in the absence of radiation. And this is what we've done, published a bunch of papers on it, including 3 papers on Fukushima birds just this spring. In Chernobyl, basically, abundances during the time period that we looked at it 10 years ago, about one-third as many birds as there should be in the more highly contaminated areas, about half as many species. Fukushima, that's the one everybody's interested in. After 4 years of repeated sampling, this is what we find. Huge impacts. Dramatically fewer birds in the areas of high radiation. Many dramatically fewer species of birds as well. What I wanted to do was to show you what it sounds like. This is an area that's relatively normal. This is an area up the road, and this is not a scientific analysis, obviously. 15 miles up the road, very high radiation level in Fukushima. Since it was July, and call this a silent summer effect, it's really a dead zone. There are no butterflies, no birds, very few. And it's very, very clearly the result of the radioactive contaminants. So what does this all mean? Contrary to those important reports by government agencies, there's clearly an abundance of information. It's not just our data that's showing that there are consequences of the levels of contamination that we see in Fukushima and Chernobyl. In other words, injuries to individuals, population, species, and even ecosystem functioning, I didn't have time to talk about today, but trust me. Long list of major findings, mutations, phenotypic effects, reproductive effects, effects on longevity. Everything that you would predict that radiation might do, we can see in Chernobyl and Fukushima. So what are we going to do about it? We're hoping that we can mount a serious scientific effort to document a range of biological consequences, that we can document the range of relationships with different dose rates for these different organisms. We found tremendous variability among individuals and species in the responses, and some species have actually shown adaptive responses, positive responses, evolved adaptive responses. We need to know a lot more about what the constraints are. But this effort, needs to be conducted by independent scientists, scientists at universities or at research institutions that are not directly part of any governmental agency or any regulatory body. And why does it matter to you? You recognize this? Look at that. It's right there, right on the water. I hear there are 20 fault zones surrounding it. And then, of course, the other reason is it's coming. It is coming. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
And what Professor Timothy Musso was showing was the image of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in California sitting at the ocean in the crosshairs of 20 earthquake faults. That was an update of the courageous and solitary work of Timothy Musso and his colleague Anders Moller. Musso is professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. Moller teaches at the University Paris Sud in France. You can find a link to their website at tucradio.org. Tim Musso spoke on September 2, 2015, at Point Reyes Station in California. Many thanks to Bing Gong and Mary Beth Brangen for letting me use their recording. The full audio file is on postcarbon.podomatic.com. That's postcarbon.podomatic.com. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.